All right, welcome everyone to Cold Blooded Conversations, and we have probably the best guest we will ever have in the history of this show. Everyone knows that I grew up on Steve Irwin and I idolized him, but this guy is like Steve Irwin on steroids. Foremost expert in the world on gharials, king cobras, just one of the greatest, if not the greatest, herpetologist of all time, Mr. Romulus Whitaker. I'm sure we could go on for hours and days, but we'll contain it. I want to first mention your book that just came out last year, Snakes, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
And I have about 200 or 300 books. Awesome. Yes. I have about 200 or 300 books in queue that need to be read, and that one actually made its way quickly to the front of that list. It's about 400 pages or so, and I have read presidential biographies that are shorter. And usually when a book is that long, it's full of a bunch of filler nonsense. But I'll tell you, every last word in this book, I couldn't put it down. I finished it in 3 days. It was just, I mean, here you are 10 years old and I'm hanging on every word you wrote. Very well written, such an amazing, amazing life. And that only covered about a third of it. Am I correct on that? That's
right. Up to 20, age 24. I'm still flabbergasted over all the stuff that went into it.
Oh, it's fascinating. What caused you, when did you decide to finally write your life down for all of us to be a part of?
But over the years, I'm kind of a natural storyteller, I guess. I don't know. It's just fun to see people's reactions. And people continually say, yeah, you ought to write a book. You ought to write a book. And then, you know, in the midst of doing all the stuff that I'm doing, to write a book, well, that's going to take quite a bit of effort. But I've got a wonderful wife, Janaki Lennon, and she's a writer primarily. We were filmmakers together for several years. And then she said, nah, no more filmmaking for me. I'm going to write. And she has. She's produced a couple of wonderful books. And she said, okay, let's get cracking on this autobiography of yours. That was 5 or 6 years ago. So it takes a while to put a good book together.
Now, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, and if I'm not, I'll cut it out. But there are two more volumes on the way.
Yeah, but definitely there are two more volumes, and we're hard at work on the second volume. And that, the first volume sort of starts 1943 when I was born up to 1967 when I had already grew up in India, went back to the United States, and then I returned to India in 1967. And the 1967 to 1985 period is when I set up the Madras Snake Park. And with my ex-wife, Zai, the Madras Crocodile Bank. And man, I was a big non-government organization setter-upper. We'll get into that when we get into volume two.
I mean, what I really like is we see the stories of all of these successful people, from presidents to musicians to sports stars. And a lot of people don't know the backstory behind it. You really, pardon my language, you worked your ass off to get where you were. You had this dream, and not many people have that dream, and you just went right into it, and you're who you are right now. But the first question I love to ask everyone is, how did you get involved in reptiles? What turned you on to liking reptiles so much?
Well, it's pretty clearly stated in the book, so you guys out there get it and read it. But I can tell you briefly that it was my mother who turned me on to reptiles. I mean, I went out, you know, collecting stuff just the way any little kid would do, looking at bugs and, you know, being fascinated by creepy crawlies. Luckily, we lived in a place in northern New York State, a little village called Hoosick on the Vermont border. And my mother knew there were no venomous snakes there. So when I went out into the fields and goofed off, she knew that, man, I'd probably get stung by a few bees or wasps or something, but I wasn't going to, you know, handle any dangerous creatures. So when I brought a snake home, a milk snake, she just said, wow, how gorgeous. And, you know, that precise moment is probably the moment when I just fell in love with snakes. And from there, it was a roller coaster because, you know, people's reaction to snakes. I really objected to people saying, oh, they're filthy, they're slimy, they're, you know, they're horrible, they're venomous, you know, this and that. So I was their
Ignorance.
champion from the time I was 4 years old.
I was in a law enforcement conference all week, and the topic of snakes came up. And of course, half the people, oh, the only good snake is a dead snake, blah, blah, blah. And there's
Oh
a
boy.
there were myself and another gentleman in the class both keep snakes, and we had to set them straight in so many
It's
words.
tough, but yeah, we
I
gotta
mean,
do it.
okay, you don't like them, that's fine. Just leave them alone. The snake
Yeah.
doesn't want to invade your space. We took their
Absolutely.
space.
Absolutely.
Ugh. All right, so a little excerpt from the book that I picked out because it's really good. So you were honorably discharged from the US Army in January of 67, and you only had one thing on your mind, and that was getting back to India.
Right.
United States just wasn't doing it. You said you didn't like school very much. So you needed to raise $500 to get back on the ship to get to India. And you were in touch with the famous director of the Staten Island Zoo, Carl Caulfield, who told you he'd pay you good money for some Arizona rattlesnakes and the smaller mountain species like the green rocks, the willards, the prices. And you knew that the Huachuca Mountains were the best place to get these guys. So that's where this passage picks up from.
Go ahead.
I walk carefully across a massive rock slide, alert for the soft buzz of a small rattler. At the first sound of one, I excavated the rocks, but the rattle grew fainter. The snake had retreated inside. I had to be faster next time. Careful not to start a landslide, I made my way. Another snake disappeared under a flat rock. On lifting the stone, I caught sight of a slate gray coil near my hand. Too late. The small lance-shaped head of a green rock rattler shot out and bit deep into my left thumb. You dumb shit, I berated myself. My thumbs burned like a hot iron drilling into flesh. This was no dry bite. Although in pain, I wanted the snake. I grabbed it with my tongs and dumped it into a bag. Not knowing how had the snake bite was going to be, I didn't waste my time in that remote spot and retrace my steps for the 3 hour hike back to Nell's barn, and Nell was the caretaker of the property. Exhausted from the agony, I slumped beneath a stream and drank deeply. I made an improvised sling with a bag for my throbbing hand and rested it in the shade of a tree for a few minutes. The swollen thumb had turned blue like an overripe fruit, stiffened and oozed fluid from the puncture wounds. I wiped it with a damp handkerchief and tied it loosely around the bite to keep the flies away. My small medical kit contained no painkillers. I did, however, have a stash of marijuana. I tamped a thimbleful into a corncob pipe for a smoke. The familiar high took the edge off the agony. I felt better enough to continue on my way. About a mile later, I began sneezing nonstop, which made me even more tired. Then my armpit, crotch, and head started itching. I had no time to dwell on this new, unfamiliar symptom of an allergic reaction to venom. The distance passed in a blur. The sneezing abated, but I continued to scratch as if bedeviled by fleas. A parked car stood in Nell's yard, and the sound of people's voices came from the house. If her guests saw my puffy face with a snotty nose while I raked my privates like an uncouth simpleton, they would run a mile. I stumbled behind the barn without being spotted and sat under an apple tree with my back resting against the trunk. Sweat trickled from my brow and my shirt was damp. I toked on the corncob pipe, which eased the pain. Two snake bags stuffed with dry leaves made good pillows, and I stretched out, gazing into the branches. I sank into a deep sleep, listening to the redstarts warbling among the overhead foliage. When I woke up, I had no sense of what time it was or how much time had gone by since my watch busted days earlier. A troop of Cootamundis surrounded me, chewing on fallen apples. Am I hallucinating? They kept a wary eye on the prone human. When I propped myself up to a sitting position, they scattered and watched me from a distance. The swelling had now reached the elbow. A deep, dull ache that throbbed with my pulse replaced the burning pain. I peeked around the barn. The car had left. I knocked on the door and told Nell about the bite. My swollen arm concerned her, and she urged me to leave for the hospital. The nearest one at Bisbee was an hour's drive away, and my last excruciating experience at Beaumont lingered in my memory. It was a tiny snake, I reassured her. It couldn't be dangerous. The swelling has stopped, and it's not even painful anymore. I'll be fine. It doesn't look good, she said. Anyway, you better stay in the house. After we had a sumptuous dinner of deer steak and baked potatoes, she pointed me to her guest room. At night, I got up in the pitch dark to take a leak, but lost my balance and fell down. I was blind. 100 worries assailed me as I lay there. I should have taken Nell's advice and gone to the hospital, but now it's too late. Should I call for help? Am I dying? Should I ask her to drive me to Bisbee? I had already worried her enough. I sat up, paralyzed by fear and uncertainty. About an hour later, my vision started returning, like an old television set warming up. The nightlight and the furniture were blurred at first, and then they came into sharper focus. Unsteadily, I stood up and leaned against the wall, waiting for my balance to return. I staggered into the bathroom and returned to bed. I woke to bird song in the morning sun streaming in through the window. My hand was stiff and sore, but much better than the previous day. After a breakfast of French toast with maple syrup washed down with strong coffee, Nell bandaged my thumb. Against her advice, I went into the mountains to catch snakes despite the discomfort. During the following 2 days, I caught three more green rocks, two willards, and two blacktail rattlesnakes with my right hand. Well, I don't know about you or the rest of the listeners, but I'm to the point I'm going to be scratching my head and armpits from that description. And that was not
Yeah.
your first bite, but that sounds like a truly horrifying experience. And I don't think in a discussion we would get details like this. So that's one of the really high points of the book. Did you have you had any bites since that?
I you know, we all of us snake people have, hundreds, if not thousands, of non-venomous bites. But
Yes.
no, I've been much, much more careful. And, coming back to India, where we've got some fairly seriously dangerous snakes, I've been very, very safe with handling. And, I perhaps learned my lesson with that bite. I'll just tell you briefly, this is kind of a preview of volume three, actually, but I was over in Australia helping to make a film about crocodiles. But we were driving from one place to another, and I saw a snake starting to cross the road. And there was heavy traffic, so I did the obvious thing. I jumped out of the car and grabbed it by the tail to flick it back off the road. And it tagged me on the finger. And Australia is a funny country because most of the snakes are venomous there.
And they all look the
And
same.
this is just a long black snake, and it could have been one of several very, very dangerous snakes. So I had to catch it and determine whether it was venomous or not. So I did. I caught it and pinned it. And I opened its mouth with its twig, and sure enough, it had fangs. And I said, yeah, right. Okay. Anyway, I thought I'd identified it as a Papuan whip snake. That's one of the names for it. And when I got back to where I was staying, I had Hal Cogger's Snakes of Australia book, and sure enough, it was the Papuan whip snake, which is, the bite is not serious, but the hand did swell up, turned a bit purple, and stuff like that. But man, how stupid can you be? And I was in my 60s by then, and you should have learned by then, I kicked myself. Anyway, I survived that and I went through a bit of a problem in the middle of the night. My heart went up to 160 or something, the heartbeat. But other than that, yeah, it was okay.
I was talking a few weeks ago with Jim Harrison and Kristen Wiley, and we were talking about Jim's 15 bites. And in his line of work with hundreds of thousands of handlings, something is going to happen. It's not due to carelessness, it's just a freak thing. Like in the facility where I work, no one has ever taken a bite, mainly because we don't screw around, we don't take snakes out and for YouTube or whatever. The advent of YouTube and TikTok is just bringing out a whole new breed of stupidity.
Yeah, here
And
too.
stuff like that, unfortunately, brings a bad name to people like you and myself and everyone who does things right.
Well, a bad news to snakes too, because
Yeah.
no one ever blames the stupid idiot who did it. They blame the
Yeah.
snake. Oh, how awful. Well,
Yeah.
God,
Well, as Jim said, snakes don't have a guidebook. They don't know how they're supposed to act.
Yeah,
They're snakes.
exactly.
Leave them
Exactly.
alone.
Right.
So, moving into king cobras, you have worked extensively with king cobras. So, to start off, what made you so fascinated with king cobras?
I think anyone who's interested in snakes, or almost anybody in the world, is fascinated by what is called the largest venomous snake in the world.
Correct.
And king cobras are so majestic and so
Yes,
incredible
yes.
that from the time I was little, that's a snake that I had to meet, I had to do something with. I mean, it was just one of those magical creatures which I had to meet at some stage in my life, and I was just so lucky that I live in South India, where there's one area where we work now, where they're fairly common. So yeah, I can't explain it even be any better than that. It's just a fascinating animal.
So whenever I'd gone to a zoo, they'd have a king cobra on display, and it's always a very small specimen. But when I started working at the reptile zoo I'm at now, we have, when I got there, a 14 footer.
Wow. Yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous
Yeah.
snake. And there's, I mean, we could talk for hours about king cobras.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I've read, correct me if I'm wrong, if you are convicted of killing a king cobra in India, you can get 5 to 6 years in prison. Is that still the law?
That's still the law. And in fact, all snakes are protected in India, despite the fact that
Wonderful.
58,000 people are killed by snakes in India. And everyone who sort of looks at that or hears that is in great wonderment. How did the government sort of justify that? Okay, it started because sna the snake skin industry was huge. As many as 10 million snake skins were exported every year back in the early 70s at the peak. And then the laws came, which, the laws came right down very strictly to protect snakes because of their, well, l luckily the government realized that these are very important rodent controllers, for one
Yes.
thing, and part of our biodiversity. So the government does do some sensible things sometimes.
And
And
I love that fact because here in the United States, and I'm in North Carolina, people get less time in prison for killing other humans. So that's a pretty significant law. I'm all for it. I love it.
it is. Not many people do get convicted for that. That's true. And usually there is a caveat to the law that if you're killing a dangerous animal, for example, a tiger or a leopard or an elephant, which is about to kill you,
Right.
and you can prove it, then you're not convicted of any offense because you've saved your life or saved
Right.
somebody's life. So it's just a good law because it prevents people from going out seeking snakes to kill and killing them for the skins. So
Yeah,
yeah, it's
that's.
a very effective law.
And again, King Cobra is so awesome. I understand they can see they have great eyesight. Snakes do not have good eyesight. They can see a human silhouette at about 100 meters. And I also hear that they can growl. Have you ever experienced that?
Oh yes, oh yes. In fact, numerous times, and one of the most dramatic one was when I've caught my, I think my second king cobra that I found in the wild. It was the time of day was just getting. I mean, it was just getting dark, and when I approached, what I thought I heard a snake crawling through the leaves, and I got too close to it, and I heard this, roar, and I looked down, and sure enough, there was a king cobra. It was growling at me. And some research has been done on this, and it's apparently part of the trachea, which has little perforate, well, not real perforations, but small holes which create this growling effect. It's true of a couple of other snakes too. The Indian rat snake, for example, they also growl when they're under stress, but it's quite an intimidating sound.
I could imagine. So I've seen, ours stands up all the time. He's very showy. And you can see the chest moving. I mean, I've never heard it because he's in a very solid enclosure, and
Right.
I'm not going to stick a microphone in there to to hear that. But that's one thing, and I'm sure, you're I'm not stepping out on a limb by saying the world expert on king cobras. So that's one I wanted to run by you. Now, tell me about Elvis and Priscilla, and how did you come to name a pair of king cobras, Elvis and Priscilla?
I'm afraid I have to confess it was because of television. We
Okay.
were making a film for a British film company called Icon Films, and we called it The King Cobra and I. And I have to admit, it's one of the corniest films I've ever been involved in.
But
And
it's very acclaimed though.
okay, yeah, people like it, and it's just that it kind of overdramatizes the Ron
Well,
Whittaker
that's
aspect.
what television does.
That does, and but the point is, we're also teaching people, and I hope it taught people that snakes are on the defensive. They're not on the offensive. They're not aggressive.
Right.
They're just trying to protect themselves against the most dangerous animal in the world, us. So yeah, that's how the names were put onto the snakes that we had in captivity. We were heading a captive breeding program, primarily to supply young king cobras to zoos, because we found that zoos in India, which weren't doing very well with their reptile houses, in fact, animals were just dying like flies, were getting king cobras from the wild continually. As soon as one died, they would get another one from the wild. So we decided that we'd try to have a breeding program where we could supply captive bred king cobras rather than and teach them how to keep them carefully. It worked for some years. We haven't continued this, but now the laws are much stricter about catching king cobras in the wild, so they're fairly safe in most places.
Well, that was going to be my next question. How are the laws on catching wild caught kings?
The laws are a zoo has to take a permit to catch to get a wild caught king cobra, and it would be very important, and I wish it would happen again. I don't know if we can do it, but one of the breeding centers for reptiles in India should concentrate on being able to supply king cobras to other zoos. This would be an extremely good thing to revive.
Because they are difficult to breed in captivity from the people that I know that have tried and have done. Now, you had a very large facility for breeding king cobras, correct?
Yeah, we did. Actually, it was interesting because somebody said, it looks like you've got horse stables. We built a long building with several rooms. I think we had 8 rooms, and each room contained a pair of king cobras. Hopefully a male and a female, which would eventually produce nests. And we did. We were pretty effective at it. And this was all filmed as well. So, we documented a lot of very interesting behaviors about king cobras. And that was before we started the radio telemetry project, which we did with wild king cobras, which was actually, to me, much more fun
Of
and
course.
much more rewarding, I would say, because the captive stuff was very interesting, because here you are able to look at things close up, exactly how the male gets the female excited, how she has to lift her tail up so to give access to her cloaca to the male. All this kind of stuff was very, very interesting, but the wild stuff we did with telemetry was far more interesting, and it continues to be.
Now, you're also very knowledgeable on Russell's vipers, correct?
I mean, as knowledgeable as anyone can be, they are. I mean, snakes, as you know, are very cryptic creatures. So if you say you're an expert on snakes, that's kind of qualified or by the fact that, maybe you're the person who's been spending more time with them.
Right.
Russell's viper, it's interesting you brought it up, because when I mentioned the fact that, so many people are dying of snake bite in India, Russell's viper stands number one as the villain, so to speak, of the piece. And it's primarily because they are sedentary They're nocturnal, and they dwell fairly close to humans because they love rodents, and rodents love humans.
Right.
So we in India, we have something called what I termed many, many years ago, the Big Four venomous snakes, which cause the most serious bites and the most fatalities. And Russell's viper, cobra, crate, and sawscale viper are the Big Four, and Russell's viper stands number one. And I think you could probably call it the most dangerous snake in the world in terms of how many people it seriously bites and even kills. So yeah, that's putting Russell's viper in a perspective. Looking at it, strictly from a, just looking at it, it's a beautiful snake. It's
Yes,
a
yep.
gorgeous creature. And it again, like all snakes, it's very frightened of humans, and it tries to warn you. It hisses like a pressure
Oh, it
cooker.
does. Yep.
And
So, well, I wanted to bring up the interesting behavior because when I was putting up new placards on the exhibits, he was up in a tree, and I go to put it on the glass, and he launched out of the tree and then curled himself up in a ball. Huffing and puffing. It's something I've never seen before. I found it fascinating.
It is. Yeah, I'll just give you a brief anecdote of what I did one evening. I heard the dog barking in the middle of the night out in front of my house, and I it was my garden, so I didn't have a flashlight or anything like that. I just stepped out to go and try to keep the dog quiet so before it woke up everyone in the house. And the second or third step I took, I stepped smack on a Russell's viper. I mean, I didn't really know what it was. I thought it was a rope at first, but then it hissed like a pressure cooker. And you know how in the old cartoons you can sort of tread air? Yeah,
Yep.
well, I was treading air. And
Oh,
I
yeah.
got back on the porch, got a flashlight and a snake bag and a snake hook and bagged it. Man, what a lesson. From then on, I just keep, when we're doing our education programs in villages, we just keep saying, use a light at night when you
Yep.
walk. And nowadays, every cell phone has a light on it. So come on,
Yep.
there's no excuse. Even
Yep.
if it's your backyard, use a light at night.
So you mentioned that India has the Big Four, and that's a big problem. So what are the steps that are being taken to try to reduce this?
Well, luckily, the government of India is taking very major steps now. And in particular, okay, this is a subject which we could talk about for hours, but I'll try to give it to you in a nutshell. When someone gets bitten by a snake, it's usually in a villager, a farmer very often, in a remote place away from a hospital. And they traditionally go to a local healer who uses herbs or chants, religious chanting. Or, any number of there's probably 100 different so-called remedies for this snake bite. And the fact is, most snake bites are not fatal, and very often just by a non-venomous snake or a dry bite. So the guy who is doing this healing succeeds, and people say, "Wow, you see, if you go to this guy, you'll survive." But the fact is, you've got to real people have to be told and shown that snake bite is a medical emergency, and you've got to get to a hospital, and the only cure is antivenom. So that's the primary sort of educational message we're going out with to all the villages. Man, we've got a country with over 1 billion people, and half of them are rural farmers. So reaching them all is a tough job, but we are making a very strong effort to do that. Then on the antivenom side, I told you that there are the big four: cobra, crate, Russell's viper, and sawscale viper. But actually, there are four species of cobras and seven species of crates, and each one has a different venom.
Different toxin.
So, making an antivenom for all of them is very difficult. And
Yep.
there are regional variations in venom and ontogenetic variations. That means that the baby Russell's viper might have a very different venom from an adult Russell's viper. So the whole antivenom thing is, wow, man. I'm not a venomologist or a toxinologist, but the people whom I work with, the people who really know about it, just shake their heads and say, we've got a lot of problems to solve here.
Yeah, we were talking about that a few weeks ago with Jim and Kristen,
I'm
just
sure,
exactly
I'm
what you
sure.
said. And one of the things I brought up, the recent split of the Ophiophagus genus into four distinct species. And
Yeah.
the question I had is that going to have anything to do with the antivenom? And before I could even get the question out, Christian is like, yes.
Yeah, of
Because
course.
a majority of the serums are made from snakes from a specific region. And as you said, and they said, it varies from regionality and even snake to snake.
Right.
So it.
Yeah, we've got a problem here. We always kept, and we still do keep, a stock of the Thailand king cobra antivenom. But there's a lab in Bangalore, the city of Bangalore, near here, and there's an evolutionary venomics lab run by a very talented Dr. Kartik Sunagar, who took a sample of the South Indian king cobra venom, which we sent him, and tried to neutralize it with the Thai antivenom, and it just didn't do it. So even though we have this antivenom from Thailand, there's no other king cobra antivenom or nothing specific for the Indian king cobra. So this is a problem. A zoo should always have antivenom for all the venomous species that
Yes.
they have. But what are you going to do? There's no antivenom for it. But people want to have a king cobra as an
Yep.
exhibit. And yeah, I mean, very few people get bitten by king cobras in the field. Only the idiots who try to, show off with them for Facebook or
Yep.
something, these rescuers. But nonetheless, it does happen, and antivenom should be made for it.
Now, I read a couple years ago there's a doctor in North Carolina at Duke who is working on developing an antivenom pill that treats a broad range of species. Have you heard anything about that, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there. I mean, we could go into that for a long time too, because there are so many remedies. An oral remedy is going to take a long time to take effect. It has to go into the stomach and be digested, and then, but there is one that's coming up by a company called Ophirex in California, and it's not going to cure all the effects of envenomation, but it might forestall the fatal effects long enough for a person to get to a hospital for the real, intravenous injection of antivenom. So, something like that definitely can work. They're going through clinical trials now, and they're showing quite a bit of success. So there is a possibility. It's just that the claims by some of the other people who are doing this kind of stuff are very far from reality.
Before we move on to other animals and other projects of yours, are there any other snakes that you'd like to specifically speak of? Any good snake stories? Well, I'm sure there's hundreds but that come to mind
Yeah.
immediately.
Well, but I can just go back to our king cobra and our telemetry project. When we first started out, we had wonderful volunteers who wanted to join us and do the following the king cobras into the field. Because, as you know, when you catch a snake and then release it, it's gone, and you don't know what it does after that. It's as far as you're concerned, it's finished. Whatever it does, you're never going to know anything about it. And here we had the opportunity of putting a small transmitter the size of your thumb into a 12 or 14 foot king cobra. You put him under for about half an hour. And a veterinarian who's experienced in this, Dr. Matt Good from the University of Arizona, was the guy who helped us start this project. And we put the transmitter in it. It has a life of 3 years. And once it starts moving, you have a transmitter. The transmitter, you have a receiver with an antenna. And the volunteers who joined us would follow the snake around. And we would tell them, look, we want the snake to act naturally, so please do not let the snake see you. And that was a joke, because the snake does see you. I mean, as you said earlier, they've got incredible eyesight. And it turns out the snakes just became so used to the people following them that they would crawl next to them. And at first, the volunteers, we told them what to do if the snake crawls, and it just freeze. It's not going to do anything to you. Just freeze. And sure enough, they would freeze, and the snake would Well, not quite crawl between their legs, but crawl right next to them and, just carry on their way, carry on doing what they do. The wonderful thing about it was that these volunteers recorded fantastic behaviors. One king cobra during the monsoon would never leave the forest. He would never go into the rice fields where an abundance of common cobras, the spectacle cobra and rat snakes, were for them to feed on. These things weigh a couple of pounds or 2 or 3 pounds, which is a good meal for a king cobra. Instead, this king cobra spent all his time in the forest searching for, catching, killing, and swallowing pit vipers. These pit vipers would hardly weigh a few ounces, but one of our researchers, one of the guys who was following this king cobra, this particular guy, his name, we named them, well, he was a male, so he was M3, just to keep it simple. He ate 26 pit vipers over a period of a month, and he got it on video on his little point and shoot camera. He made, very accurate descriptions of how the snake caught some of these pit vipers and swallowed them. It was just an amazing, eye opener for us. We didn't realize that a snake actually concentrated on certain species. For example, he would bite a king cobra, he would bite a pit viper, and the pit viper would turn around and bite him, and so he'd let it go. And the pit viper would climb up into a tree, die in the tree. The king cobra would sort of stay there on the ground for a little while, look around, sniff around with his tongue, and then follow the track of the pit viper all the way up into the tree, grab it. By that time, the pit viper was just sort of hanging dead there, and grab it and start swallowing it. And this is something that this tracker, this young researcher, got to see the entire operation. How else could he d have done this unless we used telemetry? So it was
Did
really
that get
magical.
caught on video?
Yeah, that was on video too. I'll send you some of these.
Please, please. Oh my gosh.
Cool stuff.
All right, everyone. That is it for part one. With probably the greatest herpetologist in the history of the world, Mr. Romulus Whitaker. Make sure you pick up his book, Snakes, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. A link is available in the description. Next week, we're going to be back talking about crocodiles, gharials, some more snakes, and some conservation. And after next week's episode, part two airs, I'll have the whole thing combined on YouTube, and we're going to be showing the videos of all of the events that Rom is talking about. It's truly amazing stuff. So until next week, see you next time.